Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. Eric Larson has made a career of bringing half-remembered history to vivid, vibrant life. He's done so in his bestsellers The Devil in the White City, Thunderstruck, and The Garden of the Beasts, and Isaac's Storm. Widely acclaimed as the master of page-turning nonfiction sagas, he now brings another past event alive, this time the last crossing of the Lusitania. In Dead Wake, Larson notes the event is all but forgotten as the great human tragedy it was. On May 7th, 1915, the Lusitania, a luxury ocean liner bound from New York to Liverpool, was sunk by a German U-boat, killing 1,198 crew members and passengers, including 128 Americans. The book is an engrossing investigation into the legendary disaster nearing its 100th anniversary. It is a great pleasure to welcome Eric Larson to this week's book show. You may not know this, but damn, you're a good writer.
Thank you, Joe.
I have to say, you've been on our program before, and I love reading your work. What's always amazing to me is how you were able to take a subject and to make it so riveting. At what point did you know this was a cast of characters that you could live with for a lengthy period of time?
An excellent question. It's an evolutionary thing. I mean, it starts with the initial thought, you know, I think I might like to do a book about the Lusitania. I wonder if that would work. And then because I'm deeply neurotic, it goes back and forth. Like, oh, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. I look for signs, I look for indicators. I start doing some preliminary reading. And then, I mean, in this case, that's when I really became hooked on the subject because there was so much, I don't know about anybody else, but I had only a limited sense of what the Lusitania was all about, probably from like high school, where it's like there's a little notch on a timeline that leads up to World War I, sort of a geopolitical thing, kind of desiccated. It's like, okay, ship gets hit by a torpedo, sinks, boom, we're in the war. So one of my first revelations, I look for revelations. I mean, I look for things that make me say, geez, I didn't know that, because then I'm assuming that readers will feel the same way. And so one of the first things I realized was, well, we didn't get into the war for another 2 full years. It's like, wow, I didn't know that. So it really was this evolving process. And then finally, when I put together a book proposal and thought, yeah, I still like it, that's when I committed.
You still liking it is again, liking the subject and liking the characters, because these characters are so vivid.
Well, it's liking the subject, liking the characters, but also, can I live with this for 4 or 5 years? Will I like it still down the road? I often equate it to hunting for a spouse, frankly. As you as you women know much better than the men, perhaps, is that you have to kiss a lot of frogs, right? A lot of frogs before one kisses back in a not very creepy way, you know? So, yeah, it's a long process.
Once you hit it, then there is just this process of research and finding out everything you need to know. Talk a little bit about the mother load of where this information was stored.
First of all, one of the things that also made me commit to the Lusitania, in addition to the characters and just the sheer drama of the thing, was the very fact that as I did some preliminary reading, I realized that there were this vast trove of material available on the Lusitania, original archival material, to a depth and a degree that actually had not been available on probably any of my past books. And suddenly I realized that this held the possibility that I could do something new, I could bring something new to the party, which is something you do want to do. I mean, people have written about the Lusitania before, and I didn't want to just go over the same old ground. But what I saw was, there was all this material, all this great stuff that would allow me to really make this kind of an exploration of the ability to infuse a nonfiction work with real-life suspense. I could put on my Hitchcock hat in a way that I had not been able to before. I mean, here we have, you know, secret German naval communications intercepted by a super-secret spy agency, you know, love letters from a lovelorn and besotted president. We have the submarine commander's war log, all this great stuff, which when you look at how it all works together is really stuff that can help you put together a very suspenseful narrative.
When you have all of that stuff, how much are you aware of what's already out there?
I mean, you have to read everything first. Where I really, really had to do that was with my previous book, In the Garden of Beasts, where I had to read everything, and that was really very wearing because, you know, reading about Hitler is a real bummer. But in this case, yes, I had to read the work that had been done before, and I noticed actually a pattern that authors had tended to give the actual sinking and the human dimension of it fairly limited attention, and almost invariably got bogged down in the two-year diplomatic between President Wilson and the Germans. I thought, you know, this is missing the point, that this was a human tragedy of vast dimension, and that was going to be how I was going to deal with it. I started thinking, you know, how would I have felt if I were on that ship? What would I have done? What if I were on that ship with my wife and my three daughters, you know, when that torpedo hit and the daughters, as was the case, you know, with many of the families on board, were all over the ship doing things like shuffleboard and jump rope and so forth. What would that have been like? That was my goal in this story.
Of course, the comparison to the Titanic is inevitable, but one of the things that you bring out in this book so vividly is time. How short a period of time they had from the strike to sinking.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of the Titanic, it was hours. The problem with the Titanic, of course, was that there were not enough lifeboats. Lusitania had more than enough lifeboats, but sank in 18 minutes. And sank in such a way, and I actually don't really want to give away too much. You already gave away the ending, thank you. But it's how that ending came about that is really a big part of the story. But one element of it was that, as that immediate after the torpedo struck, there was that initial explosion. Almost immediately, the ship began to list. And in very short order, took on a 25-degree list, if you can imagine that, which really made it so that half of the lifeboats were virtually unusable. It was listing to the starboard side, the boats on the port side. It was almost suicidal to launch, although unfortunately people did try to launch them.
You have this, as you described a moment ago, this rich treasure trove of information that is available to you. When you go into an archive, when you go into a library, and you spend hours, and perhaps you come out and the only thing you know is that the character Jack was wearing a green coat. Is that worth it?
To me, yes, it is to me. I mean, I realize that to most people, my life would be sort of the first circle of hell. But you know, I don't know what it is, but I love archives. There is this excitement. It's almost like a sort of a fever takes over when I walk into an archive, and especially the really, really good ones like the National Archives and the Archives of the UK and the Library of Congress and so forth, because you know I'm on the case, right? And I'm looking for things, and I have an instinctive sense of what would really help, not specific facts, but I'll know it when I see it, and so that propels me through day after day after day. Case in point was in the Devil in the White City. One day I spent an entire day in the Chicago Historical Society archive, and the only thing I learned that day was that the doctor who ran this innovative ambulance service at the World's Fair of 1893, innovative because the ambulances had rubber tires, you know, so they wouldn't jostle so much, that the doctor who ran it was named Dr. Gentles.
That's a great day at the office.
That's my life. I mean, you know.
And if you find out that...
Now, some days, I might add, most days, there's a bumper crop. It's like I've died and gone to heaven.
So if you find out that Jack was wearing a green coat that happened to match the hooker that he picked up that night, then that's like a great...
Somebody tell you my next book? No. Yeah. I mean, everything, of course, fits together in some way. But no, another case from another past book was Isaac Storm, a book about a giant hurricane that destroyed the city of Galveston in the year 1900. And, you know, in proposing the book to my editor, I promised that I would have telegrams that would show bit by bit as this hurricane is moving up the coast toward Galveston, Texas, and so forth. The only issue was I had no idea whether those telegrams existed, right? But I was promising them. And so one day at the National Archives, sure enough, I came across a thick packet just of telegrams.
When you then figure out the information and its importance, what goes into the actual thought process of how you're going to tell that story?
Well, first of all, some characters immediately declare themselves as being of value. And in this case, in the case of Dead Wake, you know, one obvious character is the captain of the ship, Captain William Thomas Turner. Another very obvious character is the submarine commander, Walther Schweiger, who turned out to be a very interesting character. And thankfully, that war log, that's a detailed log of his entire patrol from the moment he left Germany to the moment he returned, gave a terrific insight into how such a patrol was run and organized. I mean, including narrative about missed failed torpedoes, missed targets, and so forth. So automatically there are two characters, and there's a juxtaposition. So this is the key engine of narrative tension in the book, is the submarine and the Lusitania. You know, and that's an automatic narrative engine, which is one thing that I look for when I'm trying to come up with ideas as well. Here it was just there. Then the question becomes, okay, well, who else gets to be in the book? And it's kind of like picking teams in the high school gym, you know. too scrawny, yeah, okay, you know, it's, you know, yeah. And one thing I did realize, though, was I needed to have some passengers, obviously. But it's not enough to simply say, okay, well, I'm going to have a passenger, or I'm going to have this person because this person has a very appealing look or something like that. The thing that governed entirely what passengers made it into the book was how detailed a record they left behind of their voyage. Mm-hmm. That was it entirely, because in something like this where you're talking about a voyage and you're talking about how it ends and you're talking about the aftermath, you want to have people you can hold hands with throughout the whole thing. And you can't make stuff up. You can't put somebody in a place where he wasn't and impute thoughts that he never had. So if you have these detailed accounts and you can hold hands with these people throughout the book, that's very powerful. That adds to the suspense.
Let us talk for a moment about just with that, what you just said in mind of that record and how much information you have. But you have this log from Walther Schweiger. And as a young guy, already one of the most skilled submarine commanders of the war, one of the deadliest, and yet I would assume this isn't just my reading of the story, but even yours, and I would assume most of this audience, that it's hard not to have at least an empathy, but sympathy for this guy.
Well, I think it is hard not to have sympathy for him. In fact, I've actually heard from somebody who said she was actually rooting for the submarine commander because it was so horrible. You know, his journey was so horrible, so many failures. And he's a sympathetic guy. He's a 30-year-old guy. He's very handsome. He's well-liked by his crew, well-liked throughout the submarine service. One of his peers, another fellow submarine commander, said of him in an interview after the war, said of him, quote unquote, he couldn't hurt a fly. And yet, you know, 1,200 people with one single torpedo. So, you know, one of the things that I feel very strongly is I don't believe in heroes, in unalloyed heroes. Everybody's got their warts. Everybody's got their secrets. There's nuance in every life, and that's what I like about history, is the nuance. And, you know, most often it's a really good character who's got a bad side. In this case, it's a bad guy who's got a really compelling story. So,
Eric Larson is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book is Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. It is published by Crown. You have 1,200 people who are killed when, as you say, by the press of that button. And the morning they got on the Lusitania, there was an ad in the New York paper warning people not to go on the boat because it was a target.
Right.
That blew me away. Because you have to, it's impossible to read that and not think to yourself, all right, well, would I go on the boat?
Exactly.
I voted no, by the way.
It's one of those, what was it from Saturday Night Live? It's one of those Shelley Long moments. What were they thinking?
Right.
What were they thinking?
Yeah.
And the important thing, though, is, I mean, we can look back today and say, gosh, well, I wouldn't get on that boat. But it's very important when you're doing a work of narrative history to always keep in mind the point of view of the era. Screenwriters jump up and down about that all the time, POV, and try to insert yourself into the how it was, not how you want it to be. And, thinking about that and thinking, well, what would I have done? Well, I tried to imagine it as if I had been there. First of all, this ad was from the German embassy. It wasn't specifically directed at the Lusitania, but it was interpreted widely to have been directed at the Lusitania. And in some newspaper, in the New York World, case in point, the German embassy warning was right next to the Lusitania ad by Cunard. But, you know, this was still the age of confidence and hubris, and the prevailing opinion was that the Lusitania was too fast, too big, to ever be harmed by a submarine. And further, the prevailing belief was that because the rules of naval warfare had for a century prohibited attacks on passenger liners, nobody really believed, frankly, that anybody would ever do it. But this was a war where all the rules were changing very quickly, and they could not have known, that here was this submarine commander who clearly didn't care.
And when it comes to that idea, how much, as you point out in the book, and we still really don't know this, do we, of how much was the Lusitania considered a legitimate military target?
Well, here's the thing. I don't believe anybody in the German Navy, and certainly not Schweiger, the commander of the submarine, knew that the ship was carrying munitions, and that's sort of the key point. Did you or did you not know it? If you knew it, well, then maybe it is a valid target, but on the other hand, is there ever a valid reason to sink a passenger ship with 1,200 people, men, women, and children? However, the bottom line is that the ship was, in fact, carrying, and these were on its manifest, carrying small arms ammunition and some quasi-inert shells. It may have been carrying other stuff nobody knows, but it was, in fact, carrying munitions, which were actually allowed under U.S. neutrality laws to be carried aboard a ship like the Lusitania. Was it a valid target? Was it? Clearly it was, but if Schweiger didn't know it, that doesn't count.
There's a point in the book where you write that the passengers are out, they're in the middle of the ocean, and there is no scent, there is no smell. Is that something that you read, or is that something you know?
That's something that I know. As I was doing the research for this book, my wife and I coerced her into taking a trip with me on the Queen Mary II from New York to Southampton. Of course, as soon as we left New York Harbor, we were immediately locked into the embrace of a force 10 gale for the next 3 days. But I, being a Scandinavian at heart, I loved it. It was great. Bring it on, We did this because I really wanted to understand what is it like to be on a ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And a number of things, first of all, came to me. One is you can't smell anything, because there's nothing to smell. The sea doesn't smell. It's when you're nearing land that the sea starts to smell, or if there was some kind of sea vegetation that happened to be rising to the surface and was rotting. But in this case, there was nothing. I was really kind of bummed. I didn't smell anything. The most important thing that I learned while being on this ship was that when you're in the middle of the Atlantic, even today, and if something were to go catastrophically wrong, you are on your own, totally on your own. Now, one of the things that really got my attention on the Queen Mary II, on the Lusitania, interestingly, they never made passengers try on their life jackets. And without giving this part away, that became very problematic in a really sort of darkly comic way. on all Cunard ships today, they make you come down to your muster station and they make you put on this life jacket, and you have to fit it, you have to strap it on, and then you take it off and go to the bar. One of the things that really came home to me as I put on that life jacket, that got my attention. That was like, wow, this is real. So it was very, very useful to take that ship, take that cruise. Voyage. It's not a cruise, it's a voyage. The captain was very persistent on that. Voyage, point to point.
I think it's Devil in the White City where there's a scene in the book and you talk about the characters coming out and there's this overwhelming smell of peaches.
Yes.
There's nothing that can put you into that room more than a smell, an odor, that sense.
Right.
But I would also assume that's the hardest to grasp as a writer.
Well, first of all, scent is very hard to come by, but it's something I always try to put into my books. I want scent. And so I will go to huge lengths to find some indication of what something or someplace smelled like. And now this is taxing my recollection because that book came out in, I think, 2003, but I believe there was a newspaper article that talked about this particular train station where he was getting out of the train and talked about the scent of rotting peaches, which I just thought was very, very evocative. Because we all know what that's like. Well, I think we do.
Yeah. I think this is to your credit, and I find it fascinating because you almost seem, in the press I've seen you do so far as the book has come out, that you almost seem to, not embarrassed exactly, but to push against the idea of the anniversary.
Well, it's not that I'm pushing against the idea of the anniversary. It's just that anniversaries are, I'm highly skeptical of pegging a book to an anniversary, because first of all, I don't think readers particularly care. And second, from a very practical standpoint, it just about guarantees that you're going to have a competitor doing another book at the same time.
Right.
Now, why then is this book coming out just shy of the anniversary? Really good question. I don't know. No, it's coming out because it one of the further things that made me decide to pull the trigger and do this book, and probably the final straw, was literally the final straw, as being a former journalist, I'm always thinking, okay, Lusitania, people have written about it before, why write about it now? Why write about it today? And the anniversary quieted that voice. It was that extra straw on the scale that tipped it. It's like, yeah, good enough for me.
I think that's a fascinating question that you often have to answer. Why do we care now?
Actually, you know, when I first wrestled with that, it was really a tough personal or sort of interior battle, was again with Isaac Storm, which is sort of my first work of narrative history. By that time, I had pretty much fully left behind day-to-day journalism. And so here I was with this great story about this 1900 hurricane and the weatherman who sort of failed to predict it. And I kept wrestling with that, like, okay, but what's the significance graph? That's what they beat into our heads at the Wall Street Journal. Why should somebody read about this now? And finally, I just came down to what was the best answer of all, and it's still the best answer for all my books now, was here's why. Because it's a great story. And that was a real watershed for me. It was a real breakthrough, because that's sort of when I left behind at last the last shred of my journalistic, you know, bondage.
Such a great term, journalistic bondage. What is it about the Lusitania that always takes a back seat to the Titanic? Why wasn't Leonardo DiCaprio on the Lusitania?
I know.
The Titanic.
You know, that is such an interesting question. I would wager to bet that if the Titanic had not sunk, he would have been on the Lusitania. That would have been the book that became the James Cameron blockbuster. I will tell you that movie is apparently, according to my Hollywood agent, it was really sort of a major stumbling block for those who would ever be inclined to do a movie based on Dead Wake. Because, you know, when he did that film, Titanic, it just was so powerful and so big that the thought is that there can't be another, you know.
The name of the new book is Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. It is published by Crown. Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.